Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of the Yale Journal for International Affairs podcast. I'm Alex DeFrond. Today we'll be talking to former Governor of Vermont and former Chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Howard Dean, about the US election. Stay with us. We are recording at the Yale Broadcast Center in New Haven, and I'm joined in the studio by editor of the Yale Journal for International Affairs, Josh Jacobs. Hello, Josh.
Hi, great to be here.
Josh and I are also joined today by Howard Dean, former Governor of Vermont between 1991 and 2003, and former Chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Governor Dean ran for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2004 and now spends his time working for law firm Dentons and teaching a course on the politics of foreign policy here at Yale. Thank you for joining us, Governor Dean.
Thanks for having me.
So I thought we'd begin by saying the New York Times recently predicted that Hillary Clinton has an 89% chance of being the next president of the United States. So we start with a simple question. Is it over for Trump?
It's not, unfortunately. The New York Times and all the other pollsters are, what they're doing is this is essentially a retrospective poll. All polls are retrospective. You take a shot from where you are, which tells you where you've been, but it certainly doesn't tell you where you're going. Now, historically, a poll reading like this is a very good sign with 3 weeks to go, but anything can happen in politics. Nothing should be taken for granted, and everybody better vote.
So I mean, there's still a conceivable path to the presidency for him?
Sure. I mean, there's always, look, anything can happen in politics, and anything has happened in politics. So, you know, I'd rather be in this position than Trump's position, but I think, you know, we have to vote. At the end of the day, the voters, I remember 3 weeks before the Iowa caucuses, I was leading the field in the polls. So, and we all know I came in third. So best not to take anything for granted.
I mean, that's true. I mean, the fact remains, like, Clinton is still, she's now ahead in major battleground states with the new sexual allegations coming out last week with Donald Trump. His talk of taking drugs tests before the next debate. Like, what do you think could happen between now and election day that Trump could see a path?
Who knows? I mean, almost anything could happen. But the attitude of Trump really is, it does appear to be, let's burn the house down since I'm not going to win. There's a very smart Republican political analyst who I don't think likes Trump very much, who I was on television with, who said, you know, at this point, Donald Trump is preparing to lose and Hillary Clinton is preparing to govern. And so I think you're going to see a more and more presidential Hillary Clinton as we go into the last 3 weeks, and obviously a less and less dignified Donald Trump, although I wouldn't begin with to call him dignified in the first place. That was not his strong suit.
And you've obviously seen the rise of right-wing populism in other countries too, but in a lot of other countries, it's been through other parties that are challenging the mainstream. So you've seen Le Front National and you've seen UKIP. But here it's kind of co-opting or appropriating the message of a mainstream party. Is Donald Trump's message a Republican one, or it's by chance that he's taken hold of this medium?
I think I would disagree with you on your premise. I think UKIP did take over the Conservative Party because the leadership of the Conservative Party became terrified of UKIP and then moved so far into their territory that they did some exceptionally stupid things to placate the far right of the Conservative Party. So Nigel Farage did something in Britain that presaged Trump. Trump just took over the name of the Republican Party. UKIP didn't take over the name. They just changed the platform of the Conservative Party. So the Conservative Party ended up behaving like UKIP.
So this isn't a kind of uniquely Republican message or one that lends itself to
No, it's
the
absolutely not a
Party.
Republican yep. message. It's a populist anti-immigrant message, which is the same as Farage's message. It's not a coincidence that Farage apparently is giving Trump advice.
Yeah, you heard it.
Yeah, I wonder whether you could expand a little bit on those comparisons with Brexit. I mean, there's a sense that in Britain we were caught very much by surprise by the vote, and there's a sense of complacency from the Remain side. And how far do you think that complacency is replicated in the United States at the moment?
I don't think it is replicated. I think there's not complacency at all. The similarity is that the same kind of people that voted for Brexit and Farage's platform, which the Conservatives essentially adopted, are voting for Trump. These are people who've been left behind by globalization. In some way, this is our fault. Globalization has lifted 1 billion people out of poverty worldwide. It's an extraordinary thing. There have been people who have been left behind. In both countries, they are older, they're white, they are low-skilled workers, and we needed to do something about that. And we, the elite, quote-unquote, did not. And that the political elite has really failed. The Republicans have been much more interested in seizing power than getting anything done. Mitch McConnell's statement about my number one task is to make sure Obama doesn't have a second term. Well, that's not the number one task of anybody who should be in politics. The number one task should be to do something for the country, and compromising is part of that. And we're going to have to do that, assuming the Republicans are interested in playing ball, or what's left of them after this race.
Right. I wonder, to what extent do you think some of the conditions that have allowed for the rise of Trump, things like the gridlock of Washington, and you know, just the celebrity that he's created for himself, makes this a very American phenomenon. In contrast to being something that is tied to kind of these international trends that you mentioned with Brexit and the rise of populist parties and movements across the world.
I heard Marine Le Pen on BBC the other day. She was just like Trump. She was denying something that was absolutely true,
right.
Making things up, calling things that disagreed with her propaganda. She's an outrage, but she's Donald Trump, basically. Farage was Donald Trump, you know, vicious, nasty, immigrant baiting. Donald Trump. So it's the Polish government, which is this far right, people who were censoring the media, the Hungarian government. You're seeing this all over throughout democracies for a variety of complicated reasons. One is that democracy is inefficient, and from time to time, politicians do what politicians do everywhere, which is put their own particular interest in reelection over the good of the country, which is going on in the West, I think. Second of all, capitalism, which is tightly tied to democracy, hasn't done very well. It's become lopsided. The profits have gone to people who are passing paper back and forth, and they haven't done much to create jobs and industry. That's common across the West. It all has to be changed.
How much of this is just a kind of emotional outlet and protest at what you've just described, and how much of it do you think is a real belief that this would change under Trump?
Well, actually, Newt Gingrich, who's on the other side, but he said something very clever, I thought, not too long ago. He said, you know, after an 8-year party reign, the voters would like to reset the table. This time they don't want to reset the table. They just want to kick it over. And they don't really care. I mean, the Brexit vote was a perfect example. The people who voted for Brexit, they probably believed all the BS that the conservatives were telling them and the leavers were telling them. But the truth is they didn't care. They were so mad they just wanted to stick it to somebody. And the somebody was the establishment, who was busy explaining in political terms how bad this was going to be. Well, now it is going to be bad, and the very people who voted for it are the ones going to get screwed the most. Same with Trump voters, the same thing. They don't really, these are not stupid people. They don't believe that Trump's going to build a wall. They don't believe that the Mexicans are going to pay for it. What they do believe is Donald Trump is going to go out there and kick over the table, and that's what they really want, because they think that the whole system is rigged, and they're not wrong about that. It is rigged.
But why do truth claims no longer have the value they did? For example, the thing about the wall. People clearly know that he's not going to, but you can get away with this with a kind of impunity that wasn't the case. And in the Brexit campaign, you saw something similar with the figures that were thrown around.
The reason truth claims don't have a particular effect in this election is because when people vote on emotion, they're not voting on the issues. They're voting on how they feel. And what they have is a great anger and a great fear. Now, it's not simply confined, at least in this country, to economics and being left behind. It's partly the people who are voting for Trump feel that the elite has been disdainful towards them, which there's some truth to. It's partly that their culture has changed dramatically. These are socially conservative people. You have same-sex marriage. You have a black man in the presidency. You have hardworking people coming who don't speak English very well coming, and they're not taking their jobs. That's not true. But they are creating good economies in small towns that are deserted and changing the cultures in those towns. This is also part of what's going on, which is why Trump is so busy dog-whistling anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, anti-Latin, Latino stuff.
But if it's not about the truth claim or it's not about the policy and it's more a kind of emotional discussion, how do you then combat that? Like, as much as Clinton comes out and whatever policies she's proposing, she's still being seen as kind of smug and symbolic of that elite.
She is by some people, but the truth is that Trump has hurt himself because he's been so outrageous. The thing that's really gotten Trump, these are socially conservative people. So, you know, they're uncomfortable with gay marriage and equal rights and all this, and uncomfortable with race and all that, and all those very rapid changes as it happened as a result of globalization, as a result of the internet. But they do have standards. And in the standards of most of the people, not all, but most of the people who are for Donald Trump, who want to kick the table over, they have children. And they want those children brought up right and decently. And hate is not a way to bring up children. And they know it. So that Trump has really veered off the rails in a way that I think is unacceptable to most people. Some people will vote for him anyway because they're so upset and so angry. But a lot of his followers, I think, are going to have less turnout than they would have. And I think the marginal people who wanted change are going to say, think to themselves, this is not the kind of change we need. And that is usually a phenomenon that happens in the last 3 weeks before the vote.
Yeah, I wonder, this constituency of the angry white working class that you mentioned is a constituency that you yourself have tried to pay attention to throughout your career. Beverly Gage, a Yale historian, made the point last week that over the last couple of decades, one of the key developments, political developments in this country and across the world has been the decline of labor unions, because it's meant that those working class voices don't have a platform to be heard and to raise issues about inequality right. and social injustice. Firstly, to what extent do you think that's a factor that we don't talk about enough, the decline of labor unions? And secondly, after this election, what institutions, what platforms are going to be able to provide a voice for those people?
So here's the difficulty with this. I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. The problem is that labor unions are like any other institution, and there are not many that have kept up like any other institution. The labor union that has kept up, for example, is SEIU. They long ago, when I was running, decided their future was not to protect the wages that they had gained in the 50s for skilled workers, but was to recruit people on the lower end of the scale, immigrants, working people, people of color. They're now the largest union in the United States and one of the most successful. I think the labor movement is going to have to change. We need a strong labor movement in this country. It's the only way that people who invest their labor can have a reasonable return on that labor, because you can see the terrible imbalances that we have now that people get, you know, in Wall Street or the city by, you know, passing around derivatives and collateralized mortgage right. obligations and interest rate stops and all this right. stuff that doesn't really create wealth except for the people who are passing the paper around. We need to go back to the society where people with a decent education, and the education has to be better, especially in terms of training, can make a decent living. And only through labor unions, I think, can you do that. The trouble is labor unions have also become sclerotic, and they have to change. And I think they can change, and I think they will change.
Yeah, I think another interesting related point is, again, related to Brexit as well, that Brexit was seen as an instance where people's faith in experts is at an all-time low. Like Michael Gove famously said, you know, this is, people no longer trust experts. And I wonder, from your experience, someone who has access to somewhere like Yale and then is also out campaigning on the election trail at the moment, to what extent do you think that mistrust of experts is replicated in the United States? And how do we engage with that phenomenon?
Not only do I think it's replicated in the United States, I also think it's justified. Because the problem is nobody, there's lots of experts. This is one of the things I teach in my class. There are lots of different kinds of experts. You can't rely on experts. You have to think through. This is the year of the internet. You can go and get 1,000 experts on the internet. I mean, I'm a physician, as you know, and yeah. one of the things that is the dreadful when your patient comes in and has just read the internet what they think they have.
Right, right.
You know, some of the sites are quite good, and most yeah. of them are just crazy. And they're pushing some product that they have that they want to sell, or some technique, or some essentially ideological belief. It's nuts. So now we have to discriminate ourselves to decide which experts we want to believe in. That's a very problematic, difficult thing. These are all evolutions in a society which has been totally transformed by the net. I do not believe fundamentally, I think there's some truth to it, but I fundamentally don't believe that trade treaties take away jobs. Now, that it's not true. In the Midwest, it has some. But generally, jobs throughout the world, and especially on the coasts of this country, have grown dramatically because of trade. What kills us is the internet, because if you're 55 years old, you lose your job, and you're not a digital native, you are not going to work again for anything like the amount of money you were making before, and robotics. We have the same percentage of our gross national product today that we had 30 years ago in manufacturing, but we have many fewer jobs because we now have robots putting together cars in Michigan and not nearly as many workers, and the workers that are running those big robots have to have at least an associate's degree and some literacy in computer science to be able to do that.
And how do you speak to those voters if these manufacturing jobs aren't going to be replaced?
We can do that. We have to go. We can't speak to them and get their votes. That's not going to happen this time, and it may not happen 4 years from now. But in the next 4 years, if Hillary wins, and I think she will, we Democrats need to be in places like West Virginia and Central Ohio and Tennessee and Georgia, talking to the people who will not vote for us. Because first of all, asking for somebody's vote is a sign of respect. This business about not going to all 50 states is just plain stupidity. It's much easier to govern if you've asked everybody, even if they didn't say yes. Second of all, we cannot continue as a divided country. We've got to be in those places trying to figure out what it is that culturally works for them. We are not, as Democrats, going back on a support for human rights, for gay rights, for racial justice. We're not going to back off that. And we can't back off that. But there are a lot of things economically we can do to improve the economics in rural America. And rural America has taken a huge hit, particularly between the Appalachians and the Rocky Mountains.
And do you think these kind of the populism that you're seeing on both sides will, you said it was going to kick over the table. What happens once the table's been kicked over? Will the Democrat Party become more kind of socially democratic because of the Sanders and Warren influence and with the Republican Party too?
I don't think so. And here's why I say so. The first global generation, which most people call millennials, is very different. And this is where the Republicans have to jettison what I call the hate wing of the Republican Party, which is a minority, but it's the minority Trump speaks to. What your generation is interested in is a more libertarian economic and less government, not ideologically the way the Republicans talk about it, but you don't have a lot of use for large institutions because you don't need them because you're so fluid with the internet, you can go out and start a startup if you can't find a job in some place or other, and you mistrust institutions for good reasons because institutions' existence will always supersede their mission if they conflict, and you don't want that, so why not start your own institution? So fundamentally, the economy has changed. Fundamentally, our message cannot be we're going back to the 50s. It can't work and it'll never work. We have to become, and so do the Republicans, we are already tolerant, which is why we get young voters. And we're inclusive, which is more important than tolerance. What we have to do is realign our democratic notions about how to make the economy work. And that means much more independence, much more entrepreneurship, somewhat more libertarian ways. We need social justice. It may not be that the federal government is the way to guarantee social justice, except for stuff like discrimination, where the federal government's going to have to play a significant role.
Do you think Hillary Clinton's on that page, or to what extent do you think she's been kind of pushed there because of pragmatism and because of the kind of the views you've seen expounded by Elizabeth Warren and because of a primary campaign that pushed her further to the left than I think it's fair to say she planned to be? And to what extent do you think this is kind of ideological conviction that she's come around to?
All of the above. Hillary Clinton is very, very smart. And one of the reasons I'm a huge supporter of hers is that she thinks about the long-term consequences of what she does. She is cautious. And she is a baby boomer. She's grown up. She's my age, essentially. And she's grown up at a different time. However, because she is so smart, I think she realized that Elizabeth Warren's right. She would never use the same language as Elizabeth Warren, and I might not either. But the truth is that capitalism is out of whack, that we have a financial industry which isn't creating wealth for anybody else. It's not investing in the things that really create jobs, affordable housing, roads, rail, transportation of all sorts, airports. We're not making those investments. Why? Because they make a hell of a lot more money just passing paper between themselves like The Big Short. We could do much better than that. I think Hillary understands that. And I think Hillary, what we really need is a serious revision of the tax code to tax advantage investing in the things we need and to disadvantage the casino that's going on Wall Street right now.
Why do you think, you said you wouldn't either, but why do you think either of you wouldn't use this language if you feel both on the same page?
Because I think that one of the problems with the language, and the Republicans may have started it, but I think we've caught up in a hurry, when you use language that demonizes the other side, and I've been certainly as guilty of this as anybody, it makes it harder to sit down and do what has to be right. I mean, it's one thing to demonize the Russians for human rights abuses. It's another thing to demonize Americans who are Americans just like us, and who we should try to figure out a common ground with.
And the kind of the solidarity with bankers that you saw in the speeches that Clinton was doing after she finished as Secretary of State, specifically when she was meeting with Lloyd Blankfein at Goldman Sachs, in which he kind of said there'd been a witch hunt about bankers. It seemed that there was a kind of real sympathy with their cause. And obviously this led to the charge that there was kind of a distinction between the public-private. Do you think she does have two different views on this?
Well, first of all, let me say that I'm sure she was sympathetic because there was a witch hunt and they deserved it, which I'm sure she didn't say. But the idea that what she got pilloried for saying something which is true of every single politician and should be, that she has a difference between her public and private positions. Of course she does. If you negotiate, which is what politics is all about, you have to have a difference between your public and private position. You have to be able to give something away. So every politician of every sort that's any good at all has a difference between their public and private position. I thought she was very frank about that, and I think she should get credit for it.
Yeah, I think continuing on this idea of like the Sanders-Warren phenomenon, I think one of the really interesting things about the current political moment is that on one hand, it seems that the electorate are incredibly polarized and that Washington has become gridlocked by partisanship. But on the other hand, the primaries were being driven by people who are traditionally outsiders to the two mainstream parties. They were independents for Senator Sanders and then people who've never engaged in politics at all in the case of Donald Trump. How do you think the two mainstream parties engage those voters to make sure that they stay part of those two parties for future elections?
It's going to be very difficult. And, you know, these people don't really care much about parties. And that's true of the first global generation, too. They just don't care about parties. They are, you know, the Barack Obama was elected by young people because it's the first multicultural generation in America. And Barack Obama is the first multicultural president in America. Largest turnout ever in 2008 of young people, and the only time in my lifetime in politics where more young people turned out than over 65. That's unheard of. So your generation elected Barack Obama president of the United States, which is an extraordinary achievement. They're not Democrats. If the Republicans ever had a libertarian economic platform without all the bigotry, all of whom are friends, because this generation has grown up with every black, brown, immigrant, gay person that are all friends. So they're not going to throw their friends under the bus for a libertarian economic platform. It's not going to work anymore. That coalition has to split up. What I call the hate wing of the Republican Party has to be not catered to anymore. But these kids could easily vote Republican in three more elections from now. If they had somebody who didn't cater to that wing of the party.
Right. I think the rise of Trump has clearly terrified the Republican establishment. And surely this election cycle is going to instigate significant changes in the way the two parties operate to ensure that, you know, someone like Trump doesn't rise to the top of a party again. I wonder whether you had any thoughts about what those changes might look like in terms of how the parties operate in the
future.
Well,
I know what we have to do. We have to go do what we did when I was chairman. We got to go back and do a 50-state strategy. We got to stop the people from Washington picking the candidates. You know, let the Kansas Democrats pick their person, not somebody from Washington who thinks they want to pick somebody who can fund their own campaign. And this is stupidity. You know, you have to understand, Washington is like middle school on steroids. It's all about this close life that oh my God, my life is going to fall apart tomorrow. It's who you sit next to at the dinner party. It's how many times you get on television that wet day. This is not how real Americans live. Right. And there's a hell of a lot of people more outside Washington than there are inside Washington. Washington is really the most out-of-touch city. And I don't say this to be mean. They're very smart. The trouble is they're completely out of touch with what normally goes on. And when they get back in touch, they cater to people's worst instincts instead of their best instincts, which is a huge deficit of leadership from top to bottom.
Right. Actually, it's quite interesting you mentioned the 50-state strategy, really, because like Trump obviously has had no ground campaign whatsoever in this campaign. So I wonder whether, do you think there is still space in future electoral campaigns for those kind of on-the-ground campaigning?
It's the only space. Trump has done what he's done because the media is also a failed institution along with Congress and Wall Street. Media was, original role was to teach us and now, or to educate. Now it's to entertain, and that's all it is. Trump never would have been a serious candidate 30 years ago because people wouldn't have paid any attention to him and he never would have gotten in the evening news. This media, driven totally by ratings and money, lets him call into what used to be the most respected talk shows in the country, which is the Sunday News. Who ever heard of that? You think Tim Russert would let Trump call in to meet the press? You think Bob Schieffer would let him call in to the CBS program? No, this is ridiculous. And we just dumbed it down for the ratings and for the money, and now you get what you pay for.
Right.
To what extent do you think this kind of, you know, balkanization of the media and also the chasing ratings as above as against facts has led to the polarization that we're seeing now?
Less so than we might expect. I thought for a long time that, you know, there were Fox viewers and then there were MSNBC viewers. And that's true. But the Fox and the MSNBC viewership added together is about 1% of the entire country. The average age of a Fox viewer, 68. The average age of the liberal station, MSNBC, 62. Most people get their news on the internet. There is some, probably some tendency to seek out news that they agree with, but believe it or not, there's less than we might think. There are a lot of internet sites that are going to be, there is going to be no print media about 25 years from now. When you guys are my age reading the news, there won't be any print media because you'll just get it online. And there'll be a competition, and the competition will be straight news that's interesting and that's relatively opinion-free. There will be sites for crazy people like Breitbart and all that stuff, or The Intercept or one of those things on my side of the aisle. But there'll be Vox. There'll be ProPublica. There'll be BuzzFeed for a little more snazzy stuff. But there'll be sort of thoughtful reporting that is a little jazzy and entertaining. And they'll run clickbait, which I think is a detriment because they need clicks to pay for it. But I think that the free market is actually going to solve the media problem, and I think it's in the middle of doing that now.
And you think it's harder for a kind of Donald Trump candidacy to take hold in that internet climate, or why?
I think it's harder because when you can get out and be outrageous, he had reportedly, and I don't know this is true, but I don't have any reason to suspect it's not, got $2 billion worth of free airtime. He squashed 16 other Republican candidates. Probably five or six of them could have been very good candidates for president of the United States. He squashed them. Why? Because he got this incredible media rush by doing outrageous things and driving ratings really high just by being outrageous and saying things that nobody else would say and appealing to people's worst instincts. We can all have our worst instincts appeal to, including intellectuals from Yale University, right? It happens to us. We just don't admit it, and we dress it up in different language, but it happens. The media connived with that because they made a hell of a lot of money off it.
So I think, the final issue, and then we should leave you in peace, is how much more kind of buffoonish and absurd is this election than the 2004 election in which you were in and then past elections, and how much of this is just kind of hype and that natural tendency to see the present moment as more ridiculous and more defining than any that you've seen before?
Well, some of it leads to another. The media was bad when I was there. I mean, they were irresponsible and they were going for clickbait and they'd print stuff that wasn't true. The phrase that I love about the media in this country, and it's more true in Britain than it is here, is most stories are too good to fact check. Right. And there are a lot. And the British press is even worse than ours. But they're known for being awful, except for The Guardian, which I adore, of course, which is biased, but in my way. I actually, just as a parenthetically, I came out against the Iraq War. I'm somewhat hawkish on defense. I'm where Hillary is on defense. I came out against the Iraq War because The Guardian was printing stuff from MI5. And I thought, I knew if they knew it, then the CIA knew it, and there were no weapons of mass destruction. But leaving that aside, this is the most buffoonish campaign since I've been in politics, but it has its roots. Its roots are fairly deep.
Yeah. In what sense?
It's gotten worse and worse. The more the media thrives on clickbait and the less important the truth is to the media. Now, in defense of the media, when they finally realized that Donald could be president, they actually got serious. And there's a young guy named Fahrenholt for the Washington Press who should get the Pulitzer Prize for unmasking Trump in a professional way. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's about Trump and it's all about sex and women and all that. But he's done some really good work, solid work. He's a young guy. And I think for this campaign, he's by far the best reporter in the country. And I didn't expect that from the Washington Post because I never read it because it's basically, it's a Washington gossip paper. But they really came up in my eyes. And that's the kind of stuff you've got to do. There is a market for really good, solid, well-put-together reporting. There is not so much of a market as there used to be, even for the New York Times. gossip dressed up as news, which is what a lot of this stuff is.
I suppose part of the challenge is how you respond in a climate where a new normal has been set. You know, you have a candidate of a major presidential party threatening to put the opponent in jail, or where you have these kind of lewd sex tapes being revealed. I mean, the standards that have been set are just so new and so difficult to respond to. It becomes hard how you to know how you keep some kind of...
That's really the coarsening of our culture. And, you know, hopefully we can recover from that. I actually think your generation is much less coarse than ours. But I think Trump is an outlier. We don't get people like Donald Trump very often.
I mean, it occurs to me that one of the unusual things about this election cycle has been there's been so many kind of apocalyptic predictions about, you know, the way that the media operates, the way that the Republican Party currently is, the way that Washington politics operates. But then also, I think this seems to happen every election, that every election is the most important in history and every election has the potential to be transformative. And it kind of made me think about, you know, comparisons you could make. Like we were talking earlier about the comparison with 64 with Barry Goldwater and right. How that instigated this great consensus under LBJ. And it seemed to, you know, signal the end of the Republican Party. And yet 4 years later, then Nixon was elected on a platform.
Yeah, but see, Nixon was a very skillful politician. Barry Goldwater represented a small wing of the Republican Party, which was very far right and
right. Had
a fair support, amount of support from crackpots.
Right.
Nixon was a very smart politician. He was dishonest, but he was a very smart, capable politician. And he built a coalition, made not only acceptable, he was acceptable to the Goldwater people, even though he was, by today's standards, a flaming liberal. I mean, Nixon started the Environmental Protection Agency. People don't forget that about Richard Nixon.
Right.
But he was a real politician. I would compare Donald Trump not to Goldwater. I'd compare him to George Wallace.
Right. Well, I guess the question would be then, who do you think could be the Nixon character for the Republicans after?
Well, hopefully not somebody who's dishonest. I mean, it would be better for the country not
right.
to put us through that again. I don't know. You know, that's an interesting question. Possibly one of the younger people who ran. The last time, Scott Walker would fit perfectly because he is dishonest. Rubio is a bit of an empty suit, but might learn a lot from another term in the Senate if he wins one. His seat is now in jeopardy. It'll be a younger person because I think this is the last baby boomer president. Whichever one it is, I think we need to switch on to the next generation, Obama's generation.
Right, and I guess a related question would be. Look, the irony, given that those circumstances, is that Clinton is essentially running a continuity platform, that she's running as Obama's third term. So actually, how transformative do you think this election will turn out to be?
I think this election will be transformative. First of all, I think it's going to have to transform the Republican Party, or they're not going to win for a long time. And second of all, Hillary is going to surprise a lot of people. Hillary is a consensus builder, and which is amazing considering her negatives. But when she was in the Senate, she worked deals with people. McConnell's already said that he's looking forward to sitting down and trying to work some deals with her. So, she worked very well with the Republicans when she was in the Senate, not because there was ideological compatibility, but because she knows that if you want to get anything done, you have to work with other people and let them have a part of the action and get something that they think is important to be done. And I think we need to go back to that model in this country and in the West in general, or we're in a lot of trouble.
That's sadly all we have time for. I'd like to thank the governor once again for joining us today. Thanks to Josh, and thanks also to Jack Lawrence, an undergrad here at Yale who produced our theme music. We have some great podcasts lined up in the next few weeks, guests including Mark Oppenheimer, Stephen Roach, and Sugra Ahmed, as well as some brand new content going live on our website soon. To keep up to date, subscribe on iTunes and follow the Journal on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, goodbye.